Well, as you might have gathered from the song choices and the comments, we are in 1 Peter today. And we are in 1 Peter chapter 2. We are going to plan to cover the end of this chapter and finish up the section that we've been talking about. I just want to say I do appreciate the thoughtful song choices. That seems to have been a theme for the past several weeks, and I appreciate the song leaders trying to get an idea for what we're going to be talking about and leading songs that go along with those thoughts. Certainly that doesn't have to happen every time, but when it does, I think it's especially encouraging and helps us to focus our minds on the things that we're talking about. And as we get into the end of 1 Peter chapter 2 today, really we're starting a new section. The way that the New Testament has been divided up into chapters doesn't actually reflect that as much as I think the text does. But we talked about last week when we concluded with chapter 2 and verse 12 that we were concluding the foundation of the book of 1 Peter. That Peter starts by addressing the elect exiles in chapter 1 and verse 1. And then he addresses the sojourners and the exiles in chapter 2 and verse 11. And that whole section from 1:1 to 2:12 is all about our identity. And we talked about all of the meaning that's packed into this phrase, the elect exiles. We are God's chosen people, but we're away from home. Now, that begs the question, why are we here? You ever thought about that? You know, if like the whole point is just to hear the gospel and obey the gospel and then be saved, why don't we just get like teleported instantly into heaven when that happens, you know? And Peter works through different ways that we need to think about our identity, but really where he ends up is the reason why God saves us is because God uses us and we become sort of like ambassadors. We're like extraterrestrials, but we are telling the worldlings of the world that we're a part of. Really, the Bible word for that is priest. And so we talked about how we serve as a royal priesthood. We are God's ambassadors. And as we proclaim the excellencies of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light, God is glorified for the grace that he's shown to save us. And in fact, other people become attracted to that same grace. And over again, he talks about the way that we live here can make an impact on the people that are watching us and the people that see what God is doing in our lives. And so all of that paves the way, all of that lays the foundation for considering some of the specific relationships, the settings where this plays out in our lives. If we are God's people, if we don't belong here, what are the arenas in which we interact with the world and God accomplishes his mission through us? And so where we start here at the end of chapter 2 is in subjection to government. He says in chapter 2 and in verse 13, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution, whether it be to the emperor as supreme or to governors as sent by him to punish those who do evil and to praise those who do good. For this is the will of God, that by doing good, you should put to silence the ignorance of foolish people. Live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Honor everyone, love the brotherhood, fear God, honor the emperor. Now, I want to suggest that the beginning of verse 13 is really the thesis statement for three main subjects that Peter's going to write about. He says, be subject for the Lord's sake to every human institution. First of all, he's going to talk about the way that plays out in government. Second, he's going to talk about how that plays out in employment. And then thirdly, he's going to talk about how that plays out in marriage. And that's what we'll get into next week when we get into chapter 3. But the idea is that as God's people, we should be submissive people. You know, we shouldn't be the kind of people that are always looking to be rebels. We shouldn't be people that are always wanting to rock the system or push back. We should actually be aspiring to live quiet lives so that we can focus on what's really important. I think that's the idea.
Now,
notice here a very important phrase in verse 13. This is going to come up over and over in this section. The reason why we are subject is for the Lord's sake. That's going to be important. I just want you to sort of like see that and file it away. Because over and over again, we're going to feel this urge to say, but what if this? What if that? What if that person's not what they should be? And this is going to be the theme. You do this because you're serving the Lord. That's a main theme here. But specifically when it comes to government, he says, you know, whether it's the emperor in verse 13 or to governors as sent by him, whether it's the ultimate authority in the land or the smaller ones that are underneath him, Christians should not be anarchists. Christians should be people that obey the law of the land. Now, why is that true? Why is it that generally this is something that works well? Well, I think because generally, government serves to uphold what's good and punish what's evil. Now, we can come up with all kinds of instances where that doesn't happen. We can come up with all the exceptions to that. But generally speaking, that's what government does. It punishes evil and it upholds what's good. There's been all kinds of different governments throughout history. There are all kinds of different forms of government throughout the world. Most of them have not been democratic. Most of them have not been republics. But in all of them, pretty much all of them, it's against the law to steal, you know? You go and you steal somebody's property, you're going to get in trouble for that. You go and kill somebody, you're going to get in trouble for that. Now, I've got to say, I'm really glad that that's generally the way things work. There would be a lot of chaos if that wasn't the case. And furthermore, oftentimes governments reward what's good. They uphold what's good. You know, I don't know of anywhere in the world where it's against the law to give to charity, you know? In fact, in a lot of places, you get rewarded for that. Here in this country, you might get a tax break if you give to charity. And so generally speaking, God uses government to punish evil and to uphold what's good. That's generally the way things work. Now, where this intersects with our heavenly identity is like this. If we are going to be God's priests, and we're going to represent the kingdom of heaven on earth, we're going to be ambassadors, like we've been talking about, and somebody finds out that we've been cheating on our taxes, what's that going to do for our heavenly mission? You know? Like, if you are going around claiming to have knowledge about a heavenly ruler and a higher calling, but people see that you don't even submit to an earthly ruler who enforces basic levels of morality, that's going to hurt your impact. It's going to be something that stands in the way of what our purpose is. Now, here's where I think that we lose sight of this principle sometimes. Is that sometimes we think, well, you know what? I only serve God. You know, like, God is my king, God is my ruler, nobody else can tell me what to do, I only do what God tells me to do. Look at what Peter says in verse 16. He says, live as people who are free, not using your freedom as a cover-up for evil, but living as servants of God. Isn't that basically what we're doing when we use that other train of thought? Is we say, well, only God is my king. Only God can tell me what to do. Therefore, I don't have to do what this government tells me to do. He says, no, now you're using your freedom as a cover-up for evil. Actually, the way you should do this is be subject for the Lord's sake. That's the theme here. Okay, I want us to keep thinking about these principles here because I think they're really relevant to us today. I think we really need to pay attention to this section. You know, I don't have a ton of life experience. I'll just admit that. I'm slowly accumulating it as fast as I can. But in my experience, this past year has been a very challenging year. It's been a very divisive year in terms of politics and government regulations, what should change, what shouldn't change. It's divided a lot of families. It's divided a lot of churches. I think we need wisdom to apply the principles that Peter is writing about here. It's especially easy right now to identify wrong attitudes in others and not see those wrong attitudes in ourselves sometimes. I'm going to give you a couple of examples. And before I do that, I'm just going to say, when we get into the specifics on this right now, I know it's sort of like walking through a minefield, okay? But I want us to make this relevant. I want this to be practical to us. I want you to have some things to think about. Think about how some people might show up at a protest. Maybe it's a Black Lives Matter protest. And maybe some of those people get a little out of control and break some windows. Maybe some of them loot a business and destroy some property. And then somebody comes along and says, you know what? Can you really blame those people? There are things that are more important right now than property, you know? Like, how dare you be upset that something like that happened? It's still wrong, isn't it? You know, it's always wrong to do wrong. We talked about that last week. It's always right to do right. But then think about this. Some people maybe show up at the Capitol because they're upset about something. And maybe some of those people do something that they shouldn't do. Some of them fight against Capitol Police and try to make their way into the building. And you know, who knows what they're planning to do in there. But then somebody says, well, can you blame them? Doesn't that just show how frustrated people are right now? Well, it was still wrong. It was still wrong what they did. You see, my point is this. Is that a lot of times people are all about law and order and think that they are on the right until they feel like they're the ones that have been mistreated in some way, and then it's time to break the law. And we make excuses for ourselves or people that we might agree with that we wouldn't make for somebody else. I'll give you another example. This has been true in every election that I've seen. But some of the people that demand respect for the current president are some of the people that speak most hatefully of the past one. Some of the people that speak most hatefully of the current president are the ones that demanded respect for the last one. It works vice versa. It works both ways. Here's the Christian's perspective according to Peter. Be subject for the Lord's sake. Not because your president deserves it, whether he does or doesn't, that's not the reason why you're subject. Not because there aren't any problems in your country. Not because you're happy with everything the way it is, but it's because you fear God. Isn't that what he says in verse 17? You fear God, and so you honor the emperor. You keep things in perspective. Another thing that we might like to say on some of these touchy, sensitive subjects is, well, this is all good in theory, right? Like, if the government really does what it's supposed to do and it upholds what's good and it punishes what's evil, well, then this would work really well. Do we need to be reminded of the situation Peter wrote in? The government was Rome. The emperor was Nero. He was terribly wicked. He was terribly immoral. And still Peter says, be subject. Honor the emperor. Now, with all of that being said, I think that there are also three things that this doesn't mean that would be helpful for us to think about. Number one, I don't think it means that we can never be critical of our leaders, that we can never speak out, that we can never say that what they've decided is wrong or unwise. The Old Testament prophets did that oftentimes, didn't they? John the Baptist did. Paul did. Jesus called Herod that fox in Luke chapter 13. So it doesn't mean that we can't ever voice any kind of dissent. That's not the idea here. Secondly, I don't think it means that we can't call good good and evil evil. You know, just because your government says this is good and this is evil doesn't mean you have to agree with that. You can say no. God defines what's good and evil, and it might be at odds. In fact, we may even have to decide at sometimes to obey God rather than men, right? In Acts chapter 5 and verse 29, that's what Peter and the apostles said that they had to do. That might be something we have to choose to do. But thirdly, it doesn't mean that we can't identify problems with our government. It doesn't mean we can't try to make a difference in our society. It doesn't mean that we can't even protest injustice or have any involvement in politics. And the only thing that I'll offer on that is, remember in Galatians chapter 6 and verse 10, there's a principle there. It says, let us do good to everyone. As we have opportunity, let us do good to everyone, and especially to those of the household of faith. Our government gives us some opportunities to do good. And again, we have to have wisdom. We have to be able to identify what the problems are and maybe the opportunities that we have to support the right changes as we have those opportunities. But the greater principle is this, is that whatever we do, whatever positions we take, it can never be at the expense of love. We can't let our earthly concerns undermine our heavenly mission. We can't let our political views or our cultural preferences or our earthly citizenship become more important to us than our spiritual identity. And now, more than ever, citizens of the kingdom of heaven need to stand out from the world. Challenging thoughts. It takes a lot of wisdom. But I hope that some of those things are helping us navigate the times that we live in. But let's move on to the next section here. Next, Peter tells Christians to be subject to masters. He says in verse 18, servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to the good and gentle, but also to the unjust. For this is a gracious thing when, mindful of God, one endures sorrow while suffering unjustly. For what credit is it if when you sin and are beaten for it, you endure? But if when you do good and suffer for it, you endure, this is a gracious thing in the sight of God. I want you to notice, first of all, that many of the same principles that we talked about in government also apply to this relationship between servants and masters. And again, what does Peter say? Does he say, well, just be subject to the good and gentle ones? You know, just be subject to the ones that treat you in the best way? No, he says also to those that are harsh and unjust. And again, I'll point you back to verse 13. This is for the Lord's sake. It's not because he deserves it, but it's because God does. That's why we live this way. Okay, so to make this one relevant, any servants in the room? Anybody have a master? I see a couple hands. And I think the reason why is because some of you sell your time to an employer, don't you? Most of you do. You go to work, and you are the servant of the person who is above you, aren't you? Did you know that the way you serve your earthly master reflects on how you serve your heavenly master? I think maybe sometimes where we get into trouble here is we have our church self and we have our work self, you know? You know, it's like when I'm at work, I can grumble and I can complain and my boss is so bad and, you know, what he doesn't know doesn't hurt him. And does that attitude reflect on the respect that we have for God? I tell you what will happen is if you really respect your master, your employer, your boss, and especially when he doesn't deserve it, you're going to have a lot of opportunities to tell people about the gospel. Because you're going to have a lot of people saying, why don't you act this way? Why don't you talk this way? Why don't you do this thing? And you can say, it's not because he deserves it, but it's because God does. And that's the kind of attitude, again, that Peter is talking about here. Now, this is a lot of responsibility. At this point, you might be reading Peter's letter and you might be thinking, man, this is hard. Like, this is heavy. And, you know, I don't know if I'm really cut out for this. And I don't know if I really signed up for this. And Peter says in verse 19, for to this you have been called. For to this you have been called, because Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example so that you might follow in his steps. He committed no sin, neither was deceit found in his mouth. When he was reviled, he did not revile in return. When he suffered, he did not threaten, but continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Peter points us to Jesus as the example for having this attitude in these different relationships. And Peter reminds us this is exactly what we signed up for. You know, when you decided to follow Jesus, what did you think that would look like? What did you think that it would be? Jesus knew injustice. Jesus knew hatred. And the last thing on Jesus' mind was himself and his rights. The thing that guided Jesus' words and actions throughout all of that pain and suffering was the way he thought about other people. He didn't return evil for evil. He didn't say, well, under the circumstances, you have to understand why I'm frustrated. He didn't say, well, they said that, so now I can say this. He didn't say that. He continued entrusting himself to him who judges justly. Instead of cursing the people that were nailing him to the cross, Jesus prayed for those people. I think what we see here is that Jesus knew that he could trust God. And I want you to notice this. It doesn't just say that Jesus trusted God. It said he continued trusting God. He continued entrusting himself to God. What do you do when you're going through a hard time and it doesn't seem like it's getting any better? You know, it might be because somebody is persecuting you in some way. It might be because the system is broken in some way. It might not even be because of any particular malicious intent, like maybe it's just health or finances. But what do you do when you're suffering and it's not getting any better? You do what Jesus did. You don't just trust God, you keep trusting God. You continue entrusting yourself to him who judges justly because you have confidence in the God who loves you and cares about you and will make all the wrongs right. If you really believe that God is in control, just because you're suffering and your circumstances are hard right now doesn't mean that that's changed. He still is. So don't let your trust waver. God has never disappointed those who have put their trust in him. Never has. Jesus is the example. But notice, finally, what this text tells us about Jesus' suffering. Verses 24 and 25 say, he himself bore our sins in his body on the tree, that we might die to sin and live to righteousness. By his wounds you have been healed. For you were straying like sheep, but have now returned to the shepherd and overseer of your souls. Basically, what I think these two verses do for us is it describes how atonement works. When we talk about the way that Jesus' sacrifice has saved us, we're talking about atonement, or if you want to use the fancy word, propitiation, right? The idea is that Jesus bore our sins in his body. That's what it says here. That we might die to sin and live to righteousness. And it says here, by his wounds you have been healed. That's not natural. Normally wounds don't heal, but Jesus' wounds healed. Jesus' wounds healed us. And the idea is that he was our ransom. Remember that from chapter 1? He paid the price for us. He bore the sin, and he bore the punishment that we were worthy of. You know, I'll confess that some of this stuff is just like way above my pay grade. I don't know how all of this works and what exactly Jesus must have experienced on the cross. But I know what I was worthy of because of my sin. I was worthy of death. And not just physical death, I was worthy of eternal separation from God. Does that make you appreciate what Jesus must have experienced on the cross? Look over in Isaiah chapter 53. Isaiah 53 is a very commonly read scripture. It's a prophecy of the way Jesus would suffer for us. And I think it makes a lot of sense for us to just read this chapter with Peter's words in mind. Isaiah 53 and verse 1. Who has believed what he heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was cursed for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away, and as for his generation, who considered that he was cut out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people? And they made his grave with the wicked and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. Because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. You notice the emphasis? All along, the prophets understood that what Jesus would do is that he would suffer not for his own sins, but for the sins of the people. That upon him was the chastisement of us all. But I want you to notice in verse 11, it says, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. Again, I'm above my pay grade here. But what Jesus experienced on the cross was a lot more than physical pain. What Jesus accomplished with his sacrifice was a lot more than just a physical death. Jesus' suffering was redemptive. His wounds heal. Because Jesus has taken the punishment that we were worthy of, we can live the life that is worthy of him. But you know what that means about our suffering? As Peter writes to Christians that are suffering in all kinds of different ways, whether it's at the expense of their government or at the expense of their society or at the expense of their masters or their husbands, whether it's suffering in some other kind of way, a trial of various kinds, like James talks about, what that means for our suffering is that God can make our suffering redemptive too. Jesus didn't just suffer. Jesus' suffering accomplished something. Think about it like this. Suffering is a tremendous opportunity for other people to see Christ in you. Whenever we're having a hard time, you know what the question is that we ask a lot? Why me? Why is this happening to me? Well, without Christ, suffering doesn't have a point. Without Jesus, suffering is just suffering. Without Jesus, it's meaningless. But with him, wounds can heal. And if it's somebody that's making you suffer, that person has a front row seat to see what it looks like for Christ to be in you. Without Jesus, we are straying like sheep. But with Jesus, we have returned to the shepherd and overseer of our souls. And so, where this text ends is again with an invitation for us to consider. Are we straying or have we returned? Are we people that are going through life, experience suffering, experiencing injustice, and pulling our hair out saying, why me? Why is this happening? How do I react? Or are we people that have Christ in us, who gives our suffering purpose, who gives us an example to follow, and who can use even our suffering to make good happen? If you're outside of Christ, I hope you'll consider that perspective. I hope you'll see that there is nothing so bad that God can't make it into something good, but only if you're in Christ. What God did on the cross was took the most horrible, wicked, terrible, darkest day and made it something beautiful and glorious and amazing. And if God can do that with the cross, God can do that with your life. I hope you'll consider the invitation to return to the shepherd of your soul. And if there's anything that we can do here to help you in that decision, we're going to sing a song, and that's your opportunity to come to the front and let us know how we can help while we stand and sing.